Shalom and welcome again to another edition of Seekers of Meaning, the podcast of Jewish Sacred Aging. I'm your host, Rabbi Richard Address. These podcasts are presented to help explore the impact of the longevity revolution on our congregations and our community. And we invite you to visit our website, jewishsacredaging.com, and to visit and like the Jewish Sacred Aging Facebook page. And you can drop a comment to me at rabbiaddress@jewishsacredaging.com. And with great pleasure, we welcome to today's edition of Seekers of Meaning, Dr. David Barile, the founder and chief medical officer of Goals of Care Coalition of New Jersey, a geriatric medicine specialist. And Dr. Barile, thank you very, very much for giving us your time to talk about goals of care and the general nature of caregiving, and not only in New Jersey, but across the United States. Welcome, sir. Thank you.
Well, thank you. It's nice to be with you.
There's so much to talk about. Goals of Care Coalition of New Jersey. First of all, give us a rundown of summary of what Goals of Care Coalition of New Jersey is, and equally why it came into existence.
Sure. So Goals of Care Coalition is a nonprofit that we started a few years ago that is an effort to improve end-of-life care across the state. It's a multidisciplinary effort. We are now 16 organizations all working together to provide better care and more education for those people who are entering into a final phase of life. And not just the patients and the decision makers and the caregivers, but also the medical community. So that's what we're doing in kind of a broad overview. And it's really a response to some of the information I read about New Jersey when I first moved here about 10 years ago, and information that describes New Jersey, or research that has shown New Jersey is last on a lot of end-of-life measures. We don't do a good job of end-of-life care in our state.
Wow. So that's, and as a resident of New Jersey, I was not aware that we were not up to speed.
We are last, Rabbi.
Well, that's pretty far from speed. Why are we last? With all the medical facilities, companies, professionals, I mean, right here, we're doing this right outside of Philly, just within 5 miles of this studio, there's six medical schools. What's going on?
Right. So there are a lot of explanations for this, but it turns out that I'll give your listeners this first. It turns out that if you are a resident of New Jersey, a Medicare beneficiary, then during the final 6 months of life, you're expected to spend more days in the hospital, more days in the ICU, see more medical subspecialists, and more dollars spent than any other state. So on a lot of measures, we're last. And it probably has to do, now there are a lot of explanations for this, but it probably has to do with the lack of the primary care provider. We've lost that primary care doctor in New Jersey. We have a lot of subspecialists driving medical decision-making. That works pretty well if the patient is expected to recover, right, and do well, but fails the patient on a lot of levels if they're entering into a final phase. Many other explanations that range from cultural diversity, lack of coordinated care. There's a great dependency on hospital systems to care for our sick during the final phase of life. And it's a challenge. It's a challenge coordinating care.
You have training in hospice work. Is the acceptance or understanding of hospice still lagging behind what the need is?
Well, it is. Yeah, there's a common misconception, misunderstanding of what hospice is. I think in the general public and also in the medical community, often hospice is reserved or kept until the very final days of life. A lot of people don't understand that hospice is available to people entering into the final 6 months of life. So if we're good at prognostication, and this is one of the challenges in end-of-life care, if we're good at prognostication and we can share with patients or their family members that they may be entering into the final 6 months and hospice is an option, I think more people will elect it than if they really understood the benefits of home hospice.
Dr. Barile, what led you into developing goals of care? Was there an aha moment somewhere on the New Jersey Turnpike that grabbed you, or?
There were a few aha moments, and you know, the first, when I first moved here, I mean, I realized, I saw pretty quickly this discord that existed at the bedside, this disconnect where the doctors were doing one thing and the patients and family members wanted another. And it was either providing too much care that was burdensome care and the patients just wanted to go home, or ageism and practice at the bedside, withholding interventions because of the person's age, and not performing interventions like surgery or so on when the patient or family member really was hoping for longevity. So we bring all of this stuff to the table. We bring stereotypes, we bring our own beliefs and value systems to the bedside, and that creates a barrier. So I saw that, and I saw on several occasions care that was not well organized to meet patients' goals, right? Personal goals. So it was very sort of a two-step approach to providing medical care. What's the diagnosis? Step one. Step two, what are the treatment options for this problem? And it's a very cookie-cutter approach. If you do that with all of your patients entering the final phase, there's a lot of unnecessary and burdensome care that's offered.
In your work with Goals of Care, this coalition of a variety of different organizations, how do you work with, understand, promote, et cetera, the concept of patient autonomy? Because my sense is, especially with the baby boom generation, there's a real prize of saying, I want to be involved in the decisions. This is my life. I want a certain sense of control or say in the type of care I get.
Sure. Yeah. So the model of decision-making that we're promoting is really moving from this two-step approach of diagnosing and treating and diagnosing and treating to a four-step approach that involves a diagnosis. And that's still step one. We need to know what the diagnosis is. But step two is asking, what is the prognosis, right? And I'm suggesting the doctor and the patient ask this of themselves, right? And have this conversation. So number one, what's the diagnosis? Number two, what is the prognosis? And then sharing that prognosis with the patient or decision maker leads us to step three. And that is, what are the personal goals of care and what's important to that person in the context of their prognosis, right? And step four is organizing treatment to help them achieve their goals. So step four is organizing care and interventions that will help that person achieve the goal. And if they're entering the final months of life, if the goal is longevity, it may be more treatment and more interventions. If the goal is a comfortable death at home, it may be a hospice referral. So it's a very simple four-step model that really looks at preferences of care and looks at the autonomy and personal goals of that individual. And what led me to this is, of course, years of reading in the palliative medicine literature, and this four-step model is not my own model. It's a model that comes from the palliative medicine literature, but it really sort of struck me over the head. You asked about an aha moment. Several years ago, I was doing a palliative medicine consult in a hospital nearby, and there was a woman that came in, an older adult woman who had kidney failure. And the doctors went into the room and said, "Madam, you need to go on dialysis. You have kidney failure." And she threw the doctors out of the room. There was no way she was going on hemodialysis, and she just threw them out, and she was sort of a cantankerous, unfriendly older adult, and the medical students were all terrified of her. And sure enough, I heard about this patient in the cafeteria. Everyone was talking about her, and sure enough, I got the phone call: "Dr. Burrell, can you come see this patient and get her on home hospice or get her out of the hospital because she's non-compliant, right? She doesn't want the hemodialysis." So I went in and I met this woman, and she turned out to be a nice enough person. But I was a little nervous about meeting her because I heard these stories. And I just asked the first thing that came to mind. I asked, "What are your hopes for the future?" And she asked, "Well, I just want to make it to my grandson's bar mitzvah." And I thought to myself, I've got to ask now how old this child is, right? So I asked, and it turned out the child was just a few months away from the bar mitzvah. And I said, well, look, I can get you to that bar mitzvah. You've got to go on dialysis now until the bar mitzvah. But after the bar mitzvah, you can do whatever you want. She said, oh, okay, I'll do it. And I wasn't in the room 2 minutes. Not even 2 minutes. I didn't even examine her. I walked out and I told the other doctors, I said, okay, well, she'll go on dialysis now. Don't worry about it. And they said, what? They couldn't believe it. And I walked away acting really cool, you know, thinking I'd done something great. I thought to myself, what was that? You know, what happened there? And what happened there, I remember this so clearly, walking down the hallway, thinking this, leaving that woman's room. What happened there was I was able to organize the medical care to help her achieve a particular goal. And up until that moment, no one had asked her about what was important to her and what, you know, what was happening in her life. So it made me think a lot about how we deliver medical care, particularly for people who are very sick, and how we need to make a better effort to organize medical care and make it more individualized to help people meet their goals. So the punchline here is I got to know her, and it turned out she had other younger grandkids. And I had to ask, and I said, well, madam, what about these other younger grandkids? And she said, oh, they're being raised Christian. But anyhow, she made it to the bar mitzvah and ultimately, I think, stopped dialysis. But we were able to help her achieve what she wanted to achieve, right? And I think that's those steps in medical decision-making, I think, are missing during the final phase of life.
Do you sense that there's a beginning shift in this? I mean, in the Atul Gawande book, which has his four questions, and there's, other books that are being written. I'm in the middle of this book by Jonathan Marino and Amy Gutman from the University of Pennsylvania on everybody wants to, nobody wants to die, but everybody wants to go to heaven.
Go to heaven, yeah.
And it's a book that again, speaks to a lot of this stuff that you're talking about. Is there a shift now taking place in this more person-centered or multifaceted approach?
There are shifts, but there are, I think, sadly, in my personal opinion now, sort of shifts that are sort of against this tide of improved decision-making.
Really?
And I think that when you think of the system of care and how care is delivered, if you think of the electronic medical record, right, or this the movement of hospitalists working in the hospital. So I'm sure your listeners, anybody who's been to a doctor's office recently, has encountered the doctor staring into the computer screen
and not
looking up. We've all had that problem. Right. And every time I have a patient encounter, I need to apologize in advance. I'm sorry, I've got to look at my computer screen now. And it's tough. And look, doctors don't particularly like computers, and not all of us embrace the computers, and we would love to turn our backs to the computers and look at the patient and examine the patient. But it's all about, sadly, a lot of it has to do with billing and Medicare requirements, and there are all these check boxes we need to get through with each visit, that the vaccine has been done and so on. And so that's been a big, big barrier to more personal care. The other barrier is that most hospitals have gone to using hospitalists, right, who work in the hospital. So you probably know this, and many of your listeners probably know this, that their primary care doctor no longer goes into the hospital. At least most of them will not follow their patient into the hospital when they become ill. So that person is then seen by a hospitalist, which is a doctor that just works in the hospital. So that works fine. That system works fine if the person isn't very sick and they have a simple problem that, you know, that they're in and out of the hospital for. But it doesn't work well when you're entering into a final phase of life and you've got some really big decisions to make. And we've got a system here, we've created a system where you've got strangers taking care of strangers. And how is it that I could possibly bring myself to trust this doctor, right, that I've just met for the first time, that tells me now I have metastatic cancer? Right. And or mom is now unable to swallow on her own, has dementia, and is entering into the final phase of life. This is a stranger telling me this, not the doctor that knows my mom for years and years. So those are some real challenges. But I would agree with you across the culture. I mean, more of us, and this is penetrating into the medical curricula too, more of us are talking about end-of-life care, getting a little bit better at end-of-life care. And I think as a general, the general public is at least embracing this topic more. And Atul Gawande's book had a lot to do with that.
You just alluded to this at the end there. Are you seeing an approach changing in medical education where there's more open discussion, not only of end-of-life care, but also dealing with the medical students' approach to their own perception of their own mortality as well?
There are incremental changes, yeah. So there are some medical schools and residency training programs across the country that are doing a really good job in this, and others lagging behind. And there, we have some great schools in Jersey that have some really great end of life programs and residency training programs also, that are trying to do a better job of instructing palliative medicine. But the challenge is, you know, medicine is changing so much; it's evolving so fast, and the real estate, and you know, is pretty tight. You can't fit any more into that curricula. It's really hard. So one of the projects that Goals of Care is working on, our coalition, we are actually convening all of the medical schools in New Jersey in an attempt to standardize this approach to palliative medicine education and get it embedded into the curricula of medical schools and ultimately residency training programs. And what I mean by that, try to create something that is not just a one-off where a medical student or a resident might spend a week rotating on a hospice elective and they'll learn about hospice, but embed palliative medicine principles into their education. And if you think about what palliative medicine is, and maybe you know we should talk about this so folks understand the distinction between palliative medicine and hospice. Palliative medicine is a relatively new movement in the US over the last 10 or 20 years. A new discipline in medicine that focuses really on two things: symptoms management, where we learn how to treat nausea and pain and agitation in the setting of a serious medical problem, and communication skills. We learn how to break bad news. We learn how to conduct family meetings. We learn how to do goal setting and share information across cultures and so on. So it's a supportive service line of care, and we help people who may be suffering, for example, with cancer and undergoing chemotherapy, but having side effects of that chemotherapy, like nausea and pain. We can meet that patient, support them, treat their symptoms, get them well enough so that they may return for more chemotherapy and live a longer life, right? So palliative medicine is the service line that can be offered concurrently with so-called curative care. But you got to ask yourself, and I got boarded in this, so I'm allowed to knock it a bit. you've got to ask yourselves, you know, why is this separate? I mean, isn't that just good doctoring? And it is good doctoring. You know, doctors should be able to treat symptoms and talk to patients and do goal setting. But sadly, we've instead of, you know, over the last decade or so embedding this back into the general curricula, we've created another subspecialty, which has added even more to the fragmentation of care, right? So you've got a heart problem, you go to the heart guy, you got a lung problem, you go to the lung guy, and if you're dying, or really sick, you go to the palliative medicine service. So it's a challenge.
But my understanding from my friends who are palliative care, I have a buddy who's was just retired from the head of palliative care, Fox Chase, here in outside of Philly, that it's one of the misconceptions of palliative care is it's only for the end of life, as opposed to it's really for, I think you alluded to, it's pain management at various other stages of life, just not at the end of life. Is that right? Am I correct?
That's right. Yeah. And there are several varying definitions of palliative medicine, but all would agree that it is an intervention, a service line that focuses on treating symptoms for those people with a life-limiting or serious illness. So my first palliative medicine encounter, a consult that I got when I moved to Princeton 10 years ago, this woman, Linda, died just a couple of years ago. She lived 8 years after that first palliative medicine interaction. I had a few interactions with her after her first my first meeting with her over the years. But so that's correct. So palliative medicine is offered and should be offered much further upstream in the course of illness, right? And not wait and not saved until the final days of life. And people confuse it too often with hospice care, mm-hmm. and it is separate from hospice care.
We're speaking with Dr. David Baril, the founder and chief medical officer of the Goals of Care Coalition in New Jersey. Doctor, the Goals of Care Coalition, that's a membership organization?
It is not a membership organization. It's a nonprofit coalition of healthcare organizations in the state that are in various levels. We have the New Jersey Hospital Association. We've got the Medical Society of New Jersey, and the Payers Association are the three of our founding members. And we've got a total of 16 organizations involved in healthcare and health education, health delivery. It's not a membership, but what we offer, a lot of educational material to practitioners that are in training, medical students, young doctors in training, seasoned doctors that have practices both in the hospital and out in the community. And we also simultaneously offer similar type of training and education for the decision makers, for the patients and the loved ones. So on our website, on the goalsofcare.org website, doctors can go, practitioners can go, and patients and decision makers can go, and they can find information on our website. That includes some short videos, but information on how to move from this two-step model of care, diagnose, treat, to a more patient-centered, personalized, four-step model of care. Whereas, what's the diagnosis? What's the prognosis, step two? What's important to me during this time, right? Step three. And then step four, doctor, how can you treat to achieve my goals, right? What's going to help me and what can we do without? So there are a lot of good resources on the website for your listeners.
And we'll as a reminder to our listeners, we'll include the website information on the broadcast page of the Secrets of Meaning when we post this. So that website information will be available on our contact information as well. Are you in touch with other organizations doing the same thing in other states? And before we started, we're both familiar with CTAC, the Coalition to Transform Advanced Care out of Washington, which is a national organization that I'm also very involved with. Is Goals of Care Coalition in Jersey in contact with, I know it is with CTAC, but are there other statewide organizations trying to do what you're doing here in New Jersey?
Yes, there are. And our executive director, Lori Feldstein, has been doing a really great job networking with them, along with our chief operating officer, Jessica Brown. Jessica just returned from the CTAC summit meeting and participated in many coalition discussions. And both Lori and Jessica have traveled out of state to meet other coalition efforts. And we've learned a lot. You know, we learn from each other. Every state is different. You know, New Jersey is, everybody knows New Jersey is a very interesting state, right? It's a culturally diverse state. We have our own challenges here that, for example, Arizona doesn't have, or Massachusetts doesn't have, but we all learn from one another. But Jersey is a particularly challenging state to work in.
Well, I know just from some conversations, just in creating training or documentation, et cetera, the amount of cultural diversity in the state of New Jersey alone presents its own problem. And not everybody speaks English or Spanish. There's huge diversity here.
Right. Not a problem, a challenge.
A challenge.
So we are, I think, the third most culturally diverse state. We are the most culturally diverse amongst physicians. And it's interesting because we have a lot, enormous health disparities across the state, which creates challenges. We've got a lot of wealth in the state. Everybody knows that, but we have a lot of inner city poverty. And it's particularly challenging with the immigrant population because if you think about this, you know, a lot of the foreign doctors trained in other countries, and people are coming from overseas and under other countries, and medical decision making is very different on a global level. I mean, and we expect everyone that comes from other countries to adhere to our values and belief systems in our medical system, right? Where the patient is the locus of decision making, right? And it's the patient that decides. Well, in a lot of countries, sometimes the patient doesn't even know about this serious diagnosis, and it's the family members that are helping with decisions. So it creates a real challenge. We recently received a grant through the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation to do some work on cultural diversity, and particularly on this relatively new term in cultural competency education, that is cultural intelligence. And we're offering doctors and healthcare personnel some guidance on how to be more culturally intelligent. And it means not just what that means is it's one thing to just learn cultural manners. You know, do I kiss or bow or shake hands in this culture? That's one thing. It's another thing to learn how a culture influences decision making and how to work within that person's culture to help affect decision making. So this process is really fascinating, and I've learned a lot doing it. And I think that we've given several medical grand rounds, and we're doing a lot of education across the state on with physicians and practitioners on how to improve their cross-cultural communication skills, mm-hmm. and particularly how to share challenging, difficult news, bad news across cultures.
Speaking of across cultures, in the ballpark that I play in, clergy, there's this huge diversity among religious denominations, affiliations, practices, et cetera, in the state of New Jersey. Is Goals of Coalition going to Goals of Care Coalition? If I'm not mistaken, we're starting to enter the field of trying to organize clergy, correct?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. So we're looking to assemble an interfaith organization in the state to help us reach those people really in need. And it's so important to reach out to clergy. Now, I do a lot of palliative medicine consults in the hospital, and I'm lucky enough to work in a hospital that has a very robust chaplaincy service there. And we forget as clinicians, as doctors, how important it is to have clergy as backup, and how important spirituality is and religion is in decision making. So it's always, whenever I approach someone who has strong religious beliefs or very spiritual, and they've got big decisions to make, I often encourage them to speak with their rabbi or pastor or whomever, to try to get some spiritual guidance. And it's really helpful. And this is just one of those things that, again, isn't instructed well in medical school, that there are these, it's an ancillary service, right? It's this another additional person or body or entity that could help your patient with these difficult decisions.
Yeah, I know from my work with the CTAC, because I co-chair the committee that works with this, the challenges even within our own committee of the various types of approaches religiously, culturally, spiritually to a lot of these end-of-life issues take a long time just to assimilate and learn from each other. Right. And there are variations on the theme depending upon the situation.
Right.
Does the Goals of Care Coalition take advocacy positions politically, for example, on the medical aid in dying bill that just became law in New Jersey?
Right.
Did you take a position? Did the coalition take a position on this?
The coalition together did not. We remain neutral because there were a few organizations that opposed the bill, mm-hmm. and a few supported. So we did not take a position on that.
If I'm not mistaken, you were very instrumental in developing the New Jersey version of the Pulse form. Am I correct on that?
That's correct. Yeah.
So this is still something that people are learning. They know, well, I have an advanced directive and I have my healthcare proxy. And then you go out and do a workshop and say, well, do you have you consulted about a pulse form? And they look at you as if, what did I do wrong? Before we start running out of time, talk to me real quickly about what a pulse form is, why it's different from an advanced directive, and why it's very important.
Sure. And a written advance directive, a living will, is really important. Basically, most would agree that all adults, all healthy adults from 18 on should have a living will. Okay. But the challenge with a living will is that it's not an actionable medical order. In other words, if someone is at home and they have, for example, metastatic cancer and they may be entering their final phase and they have a living will at home and something happens and they're down on the kitchen floor and the wife calls 911. The EMTs arrive, the first responders arrive, they find this person on the floor, they find this person without a pulse and not breathing. The wife has the living will that reads allow a natural death. Those first responders, by law, they have to initiate CPR. They have to put a tube down the throat, start the breathing process, do chest compressions. They can't act off a living will. A living will is good, but it requires interpretation by a doctor or a healthcare personnel. It's not an actionable order. The POLST form, that's POLST, Practitioner Orders for Life-Sustaining Treatments. The POLST form is a single-page set of medical orders that by law must be followed by all medical personnel. That means first responders, emergency room doctors, hospitalists in the hospital. It's also portable and transcends medical boundaries. That means if I write a pulse form on my patient in the office and they take it home and they end up going into the hospital somewhere where I don't have privileges, it's an actionable medical order that they, by law, they must follow it. So if it reads do not resuscitate, they may not resuscitate. Now, the big difference, the other big difference, the pulse form, and this is really important for listeners out there, the pulse form is built for and intended for those people entering their final few years of life. It's not for healthy adults. It's basically for folks who might be in a nursing facility or have a serious medical problem, those people entering their final few years.
Do you suggest placing the pulse, a pulse form that you fill out with the doc, your advanced directive, your healthcare proxy, putting it on your iPhone so that no matter where it is, it goes with you? Because I've seen this more and more and more with these types of apps being available, and you just carry all this information with you and follow up. Because we run it across all this time when I do the end of life workshop, that if you just have these forms and stick it in a drawer or safe deposit box, it's meaningless. It has to be distributed widely so that everybody knows what you want.
Correct. Yeah. So the pulse form is supposed to stay, if you're out in the community, on the refrigerator door so that the EMTs may see it. But absolutely, people, you know, your doctor should have copies, your loved one should have copies, and absolutely you can carry it portably on your phone. Some go as far as I've seen tattoos across the chest that say do not resuscitate.
Really?
Right? Some people will go that far.
Medical tattooing, a new industry.
Yeah. They're not notarized, right? They have to be notarized as well.
Where do you stick the notary? That's the problem.
Right. The distinction, and again, I know you'll do this for your listeners, but the distinction between advanced directive and pulse forms is all on our website, goalsofcare.org. And there's some nice short videos that help describe the differences.
Dr. David Barill, the founder and chief medical officer of Goals of Care Coalition of New Jersey. Thank you very, very much, doctor. This has been great. Thank you for all your work. And I hope we get a chance to continue to work together, continued success, and stay healthy for all the good work that you're doing. Thank you very, very much for being with us.
And thanks for having me.
To all of you, thank you for listening to today's edition of Seekers of Meaning, the podcast of Jewish Sacred Aging. And again, we welcome your comments and suggestions to me, Rabbi Address at jewishsacredaging.com. And again, we invite you to visit our Jewish Sacred Aging Facebook page. We continue to appreciate your dedication and support of our work. And if you'd like to make a tax-exempt donation to help further the work of Jewish Sacred Aging and these podcasts, please go to our website, jewishsacredaging.com, and click on the donate icon at the top of the page. We thank you for your support. Seekers of Meaning is recorded at the studios of Lubetkin Media Companies here in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. And a big thanks to our producer, Steve Lubetkin. Again, thank you for listening. I'm your host, Rabbi Richard Address, and I look forward to greeting you on our next Seekers of Meaning podcast. Shalom.